The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On this week's show,
we often focus on the extinction of the tiger, the lion, whatever. I would say this, I'm wearing a plant scientist hat. We're focusing on the wrong thing. We really must focus on the plants.
We hear from Professor Kathy Willis, ahead of her BBC Radio 4 series on the history of the Royal Botanic Gardens, snazzily titled From Roots to Riches. Kathy discusses why Kew is bursting at the seams with vitally important scientific research. And we'll be delving into some of this week's Guardian Science news, including UK residents find out where they can blast off into space on their suborbital holiday, and the citizens of Devon in England see evidence of wild beaver kits after a 500-year wait. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. To discuss this week's news, I'm joined by Nishad Karim, a PhD student at the Space Research Centre at Leicester University and handily our summer intern, and by TheGuardian.com's environment editor, Adam Vaughan. Adam, we kick off with your story. I'm sure to our US listeners, the birth of beaver kits wouldn't make the news, but for citizens of Devon in southern England, they've been waiting about 500 years for this. What's going on?
So beavers in Devon on the wonderfully named River Otter. Two adults and a juvenile were found a little while ago by a retired environmental scientist down there who caught them with camera traps. And since then, perhaps in June, that is a speculation, that they appear to have given birth to three young, which is interesting because, well, lots of people are very pleased about this because these are the first wild-born beavers in England in five centuries, so it's quite a big deal.
So what happened to them? We thought they were locally extinct, did we?
Well, they were hunted to extinction, as is the case of a lot of these stories, centuries ago, and they've been reintroduced in recent years in Scotland, one sort of official project and one naughty one where some people let some out that they weren't meant to, and it's not clear where these beavers come from, although there are, you know, captive collections in that part of the world. Funnily enough, no one's holding their hands up and saying, I opened the fence, but that seems to be, one assumes, where they've come from.
Why do people hunt them? Are they edible?
For their fur was one of the reasons, and you can eat them as well if you really want to. This is one of those funny ones, because local people seem to be delighted from the reporting we've done, and the government has said it wants to trap them and rehome them because they're a menace.
So where would they end up, and what's so menacing about them?
So the concerns about beavers in the wild in England are, well, this is DEFRA, that's the Environment Department. It's sort of twofold. It says, on the one hand, it says they're a non-native species because the landscape has changed so much. And you know, you've got arranged against them. You've got farmers, anglers, landowners, because, you know, they do change rivers. You know, they dam and they slow down and they create habitats for other species, and they do change, you know, the ecology of an area. And the other thing is, it depends where this stock's from, which they can carry a nasty disease, which is infectious for animals and sometimes humans. So, and that's not a disease you want to get spread around. So, but you know, as some people have pointed out, there's a very simple DNA test to check for the presence of that, and there's only three, you know, well, there's now six beavers down there. So if they were deemed clear, you know, if those tests prove negative, then it's hard to see what the argument is against just leaving them down there. But DEFRA is really not saying, and it's sort of keeping its cards to its chest, you know, but they won't say whether they'll end up in a zoo or a sanctuary or, you know, or back on the river.
Do these things proliferate pretty rapidly or something? I mean, surely you wouldn't worry just about six in one county.
So I forget the exact numbers, but in Scotland, the official trial has been, they have been breeding like, not like rabbits, but they've been breeding very successfully. Right. And the very tiny colony there has established itself. They've been building, like, you know, garage height dams and stuff, and you know, really, you know, they've done really well there. They've flourished, basically, and so, you know, I mean, this we've already gone from like 3-6 here, you know. So it's, yeah. I think there's no reason to expect that they wouldn't do well down there if left alone.
Well, my naive sort of city urban perspective, I'd love to see this in action, but that just shows my misunderstanding of all things countryside. Nisha, what do you make of this? Are you excited?
I think it's fabulous. It's amazing to be able to see beavers. I actually wasn't aware that they were extinct for all these 500 years. Also, being a reader of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, where the beaver characters are prominent. So, no, it'll be great to actually go and see some in the wild.
They come and sometimes sort of mistaken for otters, which we do actually have, which have actually made a decent comeback in England as the rivers have got cleaner. They're now in every county in England. But you know, this is an unknown for, you know, any sort of recent cultural or scientific memory of what it's like having wild beavers in England. No one really knows.
For us people out here who aren't that familiar with these things, how do you tell an otter from a beaver? Is it much bigger? Is it the size of the teeth? Is it the presence of a nearby garage sized dam?
That's a very good question, actually. But if there's a big dam nearby, that's probably a clue, because otters definitely don't do that.
It's dawned on me as we've been talking that the only experience I have of things like beavers and otters and things like that is probably from cartoons. So I don't actually know what these things look like in the flesh.
They do have big teeth. I know that.
This is the expertise we want on
this is the bit you're
going to
cut. That's fine. You can cut this bit.
George Monbiot of this parish is a huge advocate of rewilding. Is this not part of that issue?
Very much so. I mean, I've talked before on this podcast about bison and rewilding elsewhere in Europe, and they like bison, beavers are what's known as a keystone species, so, which is to say that they have knock-on effects on an ecosystem. So they, for example, you know, by bringing sticks into rivers, they slow down the flow. That creates little gentle areas that can create spawning areas for fish. When we had the sort of floods during winter, there was various people from the Mammal Society saying bring back beavers as a way of slowing down, because, you know, what we've done is obviously speed up most of our rivers by straightening them and various human interventions. And there are some places actually where people are actually now putting, humans are being paid to put, you know, trees into rivers to slow them down. And it's like, well, why don't you just have these, you know, these free little workers out in, you know, in the wild doing it for themselves? And I think as well, the thing that about this story that gets me beyond the obviously assuming they are tested positive, they probably need to be destroyed. But if they are disease free, then, you know, the local people seem to who live there and who's on you know, they're on their doorstep, they seem to love them. So you know, why not let them stay?
Be a bit of a tourist attraction as well.
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, that's one of the bigger, I think that's one of the most convincing arguments for the whole rewilding movement is ecotourism. You know, new jobs in places that need, often the places that need them the most.
Well, to read that story and keep up to speed with The Guardian's environment news, just go to theguardian.com/environment. Now, the dawn of space tourism, we're told, is imminent, but here in the UK, we've just got the first glimpses of the basic infrastructure that will be needed if we're to regularly launch people into space. The draft list of venues for the UK's first spaceport was announced by the Aviation Minister Robert Goodwill at the Farnborough International Airshow last week. Nishad, you're at the Space Research Centre at Leicester. Why is it taking us so long to get a list of spaceports together?
Well, to be honest, it's like many other things, it's to do with the government and where we're willing to put our money. And so ever since the 1950s and 60s, where space flight of any form was really kicking off in the rest of the world, Britain didn't really feel that we were going to get a return. The government at least felt we weren't going to get a return for the amount of money we were putting into it. And so since 69, I feel, was the point where they decided to really stop funding into space research to the extent that all the other countries were actually pumping more money in. That point. But yeah. It's only recently we've actually introduced a British space flight program where we've had Tim Peake, who's going to be the first British ESA astronaut into space.
Let's go through some of the details of the spaceports. We've got a list of 8, and this was arrived at by the Civil Aviation Authority over here by going through all the military and civilian aerodromes in the country and sort of whittling the list down to try and find the ones which were most suitable or can be most easily adapted to become spaceports. And they started off by looking at which had the longest runways, because you want something with about a 3-kilometer runway. So they've whittled it down. They've got a few runways which are not quite that long, but near enough they can be extended. And you end up with a list of six sites in Scotland and then one each in England and Wales. These the sites were chosen after runways for being in sort of away from areas of dense populations, because what they've decided is, if you're going to have a spaceport in the UK and you're going to be running these launching space planes, as they'll call them, which are really just sort of planes that are aircraft that will work normally in the atmosphere, and then they use a rocket for getting to the edge of space, they're going to have to be classified experimental aircraft. Now, if you want to do that, you're saying there are much higher risks with these than there are with normal aviation. And so your priority is actually to look after the people on the ground who have nothing to do with this. With experimental aircraft, they can't usually take people. So you actually have to get the passengers to sign a waiver, basically a consent form to say, I understand the risks. And in the CAA's report, they quoted NASA figures saying that with normal aviation, you can expect a major incident in about every 10 million hours of flying. And NASA reckons space flights can probably get to about 10,000 hours, not 10 million, 10,000 hours. So the difference is about 1,000-fold in risk that you're asking people to take on. So what they want is a remote site, and preferably coastal, so you launch over the sea, so that if anything goes wrong, the people who have nothing to do with this aren't so much affected. But it's interesting. Scotland is a good centre, a good place to base a spaceport for a number of reasons. I mean, certainly you can put some satellites, because some of these planes will be used for putting satellites or doing research missions, and you can put these up into orbit from there and get them into orbits where they can always see the sun, which is a lot easier to do from the north of the country than the south. One of the downsides, the report says, of being in Scotland is you can expect more cloud cover, more wind, more rain, and so on. So for the tourist side of it, it may have some disadvantages because you may be flying less, because people want to look down on the earth while they're up in space. I think one of the really interesting hurdles that they've got to cover is twofold, really. First of all, they have to find a way to segregate airspace so you can fly these things, because they will not be able to fly them in normal airspace for a while, because you can't mesh these things into the regulations around normal aircraft. The other thing is US companies are way ahead on this, and US companies would need to come to the UK and be pretty much solely responsible for flying, because space planes are governed under international arms control treaties, regulations. So no one in the US who works on these suborbital aircraft can talk to anyone in the UK about any of the details of their technology, because it's covered by export problems. So it would have to be a US-run thing within the UK, at least until the UK develops its own systems.
Isn't it right to say that Scotland's got a sort of fledgling space industry as well? There's companies that make satellites.
So does mainland England. In fact, England's got the most. But it's interesting because there are two launch sites which were previously used in the 50s and 60s, and I think all the way up till the very early 70s, 1971. And these two launch sites, one of them was in the Outer Hebrides in Scotland, and I'm going to mispronounce it, but it's called Uist, U-I-S-T, Uist.
You get a lot of rare birds up there as well.
Oh.
Uist, yeah.
Wow. So it's an environmental site as well.
But the UK's never launched a spacecraft from its own soil, weirdly.
When's this all going to happen? When are we going to get a space plane taking off from the UK? Because this is just the locations announced, and you've got to make the spaceport. And what's the timescale?
A lot of ambition around this, I think, because they say in their report that they want to have everything ready for 2018, which they say actually means getting it all ready for 2017. So that means pushing through this regulations. And that's why they're saying we have to sidestep a lot of this stuff by calling them experimental aircraft, by getting people to sign their lives away, by having, segregated airspace and stuff. So it's really saying we're going to get things ready as much as we can without overhauling, all of the sort of civil aviation authority regulations on this sort of stuff. And again, this idea of allowing American companies to come here and just do everything and be in charge of everything because they can't do it another way. But they're desperate to find a way to be in on this. And I don't blame them. I think it will be a really interesting industry to see coming up. I mean, it's interesting looking at the Newquay, the one site in England that was chosen was Newquay Airport. And everyone who's on this list wants to make the case for why they're sort of the one to go for. And they have a kind of, they have a number of arguments. One of them is you say, look, we're basically the poorest county in England. We could really do with the jobs. But also a few miles away, they've got this enormous Goon Hilly Satellite Communication Centre, which would be really handy to have nearby, and you could have the companies rise up. You can see how
a number of spaceports, if we could do it, you know, could actually be a really good boon to the local communities, I think. So anyway, you two, would you go up on a space plane, like one of these suborbital flights, so you get 6 minutes or 7 minutes of floating about before you come back down?
I'm a physicist, so definitely yes.
Why?
I've always wanted to be an astronaut. And to be honest, I'm not sure that these will quite class yourselves as an astronaut because they don't really make it up into proper space. But hey, you could see the Earth and see the curvature of it. I'll take it.
Adam?
I'll get completely flayed alive on Twitter for going up and for the carbon emissions and the pointlessness of it all. But really, I mean, who wouldn't take the opportunity for a few minutes of zero gravity and seeing the Earth from space?
Me. Anyway.
You wouldn't do it?
Well, no, I wouldn't do it. No.
I've jumped out of aeroplanes and stuff before and things like that. So that's kind of just like one more on. That's got to be done.
I hear there are land, sea and air people and I'm sea. No doubt about that. keep your extreme heights to yourself. I'm happy to look at pictures that other people take. Thanks for that, guys. For these stories and so much more, just go to theguardian.com/science. Coming up, our colleague Nicola Davis speaks to the first director of science at Kew Gardens, Professor Kathy Willis. But before that, a short word from our sponsor.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Professor Kathy Willis is the first director of science at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew. And to further establish herself at the top of the tree in the UK's botanical sciences, she is about to present a hugely ambitious radio series on 250 years of our history with plants. The Radio 4 series, From Roots to Riches, kicks off this week, and for Science Weekly, Nicola Davis met up with Kathy to discuss her career and work at Kew.
Kathy, you've been delving into the history of plant science as part of this new series called Roots to Riches, which comes out this month on Radio 4. Let's talk a bit about plant science. So, botany seems like the underdog of natural sciences, sometimes less exciting perhaps than studying the human body or maybe animal behaviour. How important is plant science to us?
Well, I think you're exactly right about it being the underdog, sort of the Cinderella of sciences, I'd say, with plant sciences. And I think that's partly because of the way it's been taught in schools. I think about my own children. I've got, my children, they at the age of 10, at the age of 12, at the age of 15, they're still drawing the sort of cross-section of a plant. If you give them the cross-section of an animal to draw, they're really excited. The cross-section of a plant seems really dull. But when you delve in and actually look at how life on Earth works, plants are just, they're vital to absolutely every single part of life on Earth.
And Kew was founded back in 1759, when botany was just becoming a bit of a hot topic. It was sort of taking off and people were getting very excited about it. How different were people's perceptions of plants and their role in society back then to how we view plants now? Was it just about it being food and medicine based?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So it was very much a gentleman's hobby, botany. It was one of these things, a bit like sort of early forms of stamp collecting, I think I'd say. But I mean, when Kew started, we didn't even have a classification system. Linnaeus hadn't devised his binomial classification system at all by then. So the earliest resident in Kew, or one of the earliest residents, is this cycad. And this plant is apparently the oldest pot plant in the world. I'm not sure if that's correct or not. But the point of it being that plant sciences had this incredible evolution over time, over these last 250 years. And that's what I've been doing in this programme, is taking a timeline and saying, OK, starting with Kew and starting with this classification system of Linnaeus, what have been the major innovations in plant sciences over this interval in time, comparable to the innovations in medicine, innovations in animal sciences? And what really drove me actually was originally, I was looking at this ruler just before we started doing this programme. I was looking at this ruler, which comes from the Medical Research Council. And on there, they've got it's a very nice ruler, and it has this timeline on it, starting with, you know, the very early medicines through to present. I thought it would be really interesting to do the equivalent in plant sciences. And it's been a fascinating thing to do. Actually, I've really enjoyed it.
So is there one big single discovery or paradigm shift that occurred in the last 250 years with respect to our understanding of plants? Or is it lots of incremental discoveries and changes?
I think it's lots of it, as with any science, it builds up over time. And so that's been the most difficult thing, is saying, okay, what are the big changes? So if I think about photosynthesis, what have been the big shifts in photosynthesis? And it was, you know, this discovery of the role of chlorophyll in 1913. That would be one of them. You know, that's the only Nobel Prize that's ever been achieved in botany, was at that point. But then there are other things, and, you know, you just work through that timeline. You keep coming across these different things, be it very applied things to do with food and the discovery of sort of the fungal association with potato blight and the Irish potato famine. I mean, that, you know, and the reliance on single crops and lack of genetic diversity, right the way through to the whole genome for angiosperms and for the whole genome of the Arabidopsis. So the equivalent of the human genome, it was finally the plant genome.
And Q isn't just an institution which has been involved in fueling developments in botany, though of course that is one of its biggest roles. It's also spun out changes in engineering. I had a story about glasshouses. Can you tell me a bit about that?
It is very interesting. So the earliest people at Kew, or the earliest sort of work, was naming and identification, and also collecting new plants from the empire. And those plants of the empire were, well, they were for curiosity, but they're also for food and for fuel. And Kew becomes like the clearinghouse. It would bring in rubber seeds, for example, and then it would grow up these from Brazil. It grew up the rubber seedlings, and then it would transport them out to Asia and Southeast Asia, and that's when the rubber industry began, in effect. So, really interesting story there. But there are other things. The Amazon water lily, this massive water lily, which was discovered, it was named for Queen Victoria at the time. But then once you've got this huge water lily, it's got a leaf the size, well, it's the size of a very, quite a substantial size of, I was looking at this room actually, how far across? 3-4 metres across. And it was, of course, once you've got something like that, you have to have a greenhouse, a glasshouse, for that water lily to grow in. So then you need to start building these glasshouse structures to be able to exhibit this water lily. And so Joseph Paxton, who at that point was the head gardener at Chatsworth, started to design these glasshouses, where he used the structure of the water lily leaf to design the sort of the overarching branches in the roof of the glasshouse. So if you look at the water lily glasshouse at Kew, you'll see this very similar structure, this architectural structure with these big metal branches coming out with glass in between. So it's fascinating. But also that he wanted to show how strong this water lily leaf was. So he stood his 6-year-old daughter on it, which I think is very brave.
Now, as someone in the early 19th century going to Kew, obviously what they would have experienced may be a bit different to what we see there now. What would have been the most exciting things they would have seen there? And what they would have felt of as exciting, is that different to what we would now think of as exciting?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. I think we still have the same curiosities in plants. People still come to the Orchid Festival. It is our most popular festival. Orchids first came in sort of in the Victorian era. They were collected. People wanted to come see the large exotic plants. They wanted to look at plants from all over the world and understand how different they were, the diversity in species, and then also to understand sort of economic value of those plants. People still come and look at our coffee plants. They come and look at our banana plants. You know, people are really interested in that stuff, but they also like the really blousy, loud orchids. You know, it's extraordinary.
So Kew is now 255 years old. It's notching up those years. As Director of Science at Kew, what do you see as the biggest priorities now for science?
I think the areas where Kew is a global resource, and I've been in Kew for 8 months now. I've been absolutely bowled over by the collections at Kew. We have 7.5 million herbarium sheets. We have 1.5 million fungarium sheets. We have 150,000 glass slides. Every time you look, you have these really, really big collections. Collections is one thing, but we're not a museum. It's what do you do with those collections? And how do you then use those to address some of the biggest global challenges we're facing? And those global challenges are to do with food, to do with fuel, to do with population growth, and to do with climate change. So it's saying, how do we use these fantastic resources to address those big questions? They're already doing it, but we should be doing it more.
And while you were recording your series for Radio 4, was there one character or one story that stood out as being your favourite from the history of Kew Gardens and the history of botany?
I think actually, yes, there is one character. One character that I was most moved by, which is Nikolai Vavilov, who was the man, he was a Russian, who he himself saw starvation as a child and realised that we had to have a sort of a collecting, a warehouse for wild crop relatives so that we didn't rely on single species and all the vulnerability they have. And so he started to go back to the centres of origins for all these wild crop species. And he identified where they were, many of them in the so-called Fertile Crescent, which we would now call the Near East. And he started a collection programme for all these seeds and started to store them in Leningrad, they had this seed bank there. It's the original seed bank there. And then, of course, he built this fantastic collection up and identified these centres of origin. But then he unfortunately fell foul of the government at that time and was arrested by Stalin's men and ended up dying of starvation, shackled to a prison floor. Now, in Leningrad, there's in the siege of Leningrad, but his colleagues in the seed bank realised that globally this was such an important resource that they watched it night and day, even with no heat, in this incredibly cold cold seed bank. And some of them actually died of starvation in the process themselves, rather than eating the seeds that could have saved their lives, because they felt so strongly about what they were doing for the future of the earth. Now, to me, or the future of the world and humanity, as we know, now to me, that's an incredibly moving story, but also it really shows that those people really understood why it's so vital to have these collections and to understand what they mean for not just for now, but for going forwards.
You've been at Kew since November 2013, and I believe you're the first director of science there?
That's right. So they split the... up until now, you've always had the director of Kew has also been the director of science. But the job at Kew has just become massive. And so you're dealing with this huge grounds, huge staff. And then that poor person was also trying to do the science as well. So they split the science off from that. So I'm now responsible for 300 scientists at Kew over three sites, the Herbarium, the Jodrell Lab and the Millennium Seed Bank. But myself, I've come from an environmental science route through my career. So I originally did a degree in environmental sciences at Southampton University. And that's when I was at school and we all had these terrible sort of career advice sessions. I've always liked biology, geography, chemistry, and I was told that the best thing I could do is become a farmer. And having growing up in North London, to me, that'd never been anywhere near a farm. That seemed like a slight strange career choice. So the nearest I could find was doing an environmental science degree, and there were about four places at that point that did it. Southampton was one of them. Mm-hmm. And then when I'd finished that, I then went to Cambridge and did a PhD in plant sciences, but very much still looking at vegetation dynamics in response to environmental change, environmental perturbation, and human impact over time. Mm-hmm. And I stayed on there and taught. And I really got into botany, sort of the really detailed botany, when I had a position which was for 8 years. And the head of the department then, who was a lovely man, very gruffly said to me, well, you need to do some teaching and you've got to do some lecturing. And I said, well, what shall I? He said, you've got to lecture in something no one else has done. So I said, well, okay, how about evolution of plants? Thinking that'd be an interesting topic. And he said, great. He said, you can do all those horrible old rocks on the top floor. So I went to the top floor of the then botany building in Cambridge, and there were all these beautiful mahogany cabinets. And I opened the drawers, and in there were these exquisite fossils, perminerized, the fossilized mm-hmm. fossils. So great, huge Araucaria cones and ferns and everything else. Anyway, and I started looking at these beautifully handwritten labels, and they were all collected by Charles Lyell. And these were about to go and skip at that time. So they didn't. But I started to then pull together a lecture course on the evolution of plants. And I realised that a lot of plant sciences at that point was written in a language that is completely inaccessible to anybody other than your diehard botanist. Mm. So I started to try and get this sort of evolution of plants into a more accessible framework. And I used to hand these fossils around in the lectures. So I thought, well, people might well get to see, you know, compare a 150 million year old Araucaria fossil with a modern one. And you realise that morphologically they're almost identical. Really interesting. So I did that for, I was in Oxford for, in Cambridge for 12 years. And then I moved to Oxford to a lectureship. And I'd started to do a lot more of the applied biodiversity conservation aspects of the work. And that was in geography. And then a chair and a position came up to set up a biodiversity institute in Oxford, but this time in zoology. So I always confuse people. They look at my CV, I sort of seem to have moved right my way around. And so then I ended up in zoology, but running this biodiversity institute across the university. And so it is lovely to be back within plant sciences, I have to say. Although I really do like zoology. But I think I probably would classify myself as a natural scientist first and foremost now.
And you talked there about biodiversity, and obviously that's an extremely important area, particularly, for example, for our food security. Now, Kew is obviously taking a lead role in that with the Millennium Seed Bank. Can you tell me a bit about the future for that programme?
Well, the Millennium Seed Bank is an extraordinary, extraordinary collection. We have, and I think we have a target to collect 25% of the world's seeds by 2020, and we're well on target for that. It's one thing to collect the seeds, but then you've got to keep the things alive. And so we have to keep basically growing a few of the individuals every couple of years to make sure they're still there. But then it's not just collecting the seeds. So this is what I'm going back to before when I'm saying we're not just a museum. Mm-hmm. It's then what are the important seeds we've got? How can they then inform the science? So, you know, what is the genetic variability of different groups? What is the genetic variability of these different crops? How can we use that to reintroduce those back into the fields again to make sure we never end up in a situation that we were, for example, before with the Irish potato famine? So that's one aspect. I mean, there are other things. Coffee is another one. We have a lot of work going on coffee. I mean, I've got a cup of coffee in front of me here. I know which species that would be on because we only drink one species of
really?
Coffee,
Gosh.
Which is Coffea arabica. And there are actually 120 wild species of coffee ranging from Africa right the way through to Australia. And many people don't know that. And so one of the pieces of work that we're currently doing at Kew is to look at what is the natural, in the wild, where does Coffea arabica grow? Mm-hmm. So you can create a climate envelope model so that then you can predict where are going to be the best places to grow this as the climate changes. So that therefore you're starting to use it in a really predictive capacity, mm-hmm. which I think is really important, vital for not only coffee, but for any crop to be able to do that. Then you can really start to make sure that we're climate smart with what we're doing. But not only that, you can also do the exactly same with disease so that you can start to say, okay, this particular species is more resistant to this disease than this one. You can start to mitigate against risk, and that's what we should all be doing.
Talking there about risks, obviously there are several pressures facing the society at large, not just worldwide, I mean. So to what extent are plants underpinning our security, not just in food, but perhaps in medicine as well?
Oh, completely, absolutely. If we lose plants, we've lost everything. We can't afford to be, you know, we often focus on the extinction of the tiger, the lion, whatever. I would say this, I'm wearing plant science's hat. We're focusing on the wrong thing. We really must focus on the plants. But if we convert some of our most important resources in terms of carbon drawdown, in terms of food, in terms of risk against disease and cures to disease, then we've lost everything.
Now, there's been a great deal of discussion about the future of Kew. Obviously, finances have been discussed. There's 125 jobs that are being or have been about to be cut and a £5 million hole in the budget. So sort of difficult times for Kew. How positive are you about the future of the institution and of the science? Because it's been said that the science might be suffering from this.
I can't talk about the specifics because we're in the middle of that process. But Kew will go on. Kew science will really go on. We're more relevant now, I'd say, than we've ever been before. I don't have any worries about that at all.
So George Monbiot has written about the concept of rewilding. How do you feel about that? Is this a good idea or is this just too simplistic?
I think he's right. I think in order to restore functioning ecosystems, you have to restore the functioning parts, the things that maintain that ecosystem. We can't just have a static baseline with, we want this plant here. We have to know what is the really important part of that for the seed dispersal and the soil fertilization. Those are the large herbivores. And I've seen that there's a fantastic site in the Netherlands. I'm not very good at pronouncing this. This will be wrong. It's called Oostvaardersplassen. Anyway, it's a rewilded site. And this man, Frans Vera, set this up. Now, it's completely novel. It's 8 meters below sea level, this site. It's in Holland. It's a polder. Reclaimed land. It was surplus to the government. They handed it over to the Frans Vera. And 25 years ago, he introduced wild ponies, conic ponies, red deer, and the closest to the ancient auroch, which is this Heck cattle. And they've now got 4,000 large herbivores on that landscape. Now, you'd think it'd be completely devoid of trees. It's not. It's one of the most biodiverse areas in Europe for birds. And why is that? Because you've got the animals that go along with their noses and break up the soil, so you've got the good turnover there. You've got fertilization from manuring, and you've got the seeds being dispersed across this landscape. And how do you maintain trees on the landscape? Well, the trees are surrounded by rings of hawthorn. So if a tree starts, if an oak seed comes through and it's surrounded by a ring of hawthorn, then you get that tree coming through there. So it's really extraordinary. It's known as the Serengeti behind the dikes. But I think this whole idea, and actually one of the programs with a point made by one of our people from the Millennium Seed Bank, Wolfgang Stuppy, where he's making the point that many of the large seeded species that are now close to extinction, it's because they no longer have the natural disperser of those seeds. And if you look at some of these seeds, they're the size of a tennis ball. Now, how many animals do you know that can swallow a thing the size of a tennis ball? Elephants, yep. And then some of our much bigger herbivores before, even going back to the dinosaurs. We've lost that. Therefore, we've lost the mechanism. So unless we become farmers and keep planting these things out, we're not going to be able to keep those species going. So I think rewilding in some areas is exactly the right thing to do.
So a lot of people perhaps perceive Kew as being a sort of storehouse for very old specimens, but it's involved in a very much more modern inventory system. It's involved in big data, is that right?
Yes. I mean, it is. That word big data is used very broadly now across the universities. Everyone's working on big data, but Kew really is big data. So you've got sort of species, dried species on sheets of paper going back 150 years. So you've got a temporal record there that you can look at how the shape of the thing's changed, but also how its molecular phylogeny has changed over that interval in time. That's really valuable. So there's that in there. But we've also got the Jodrell lab. They're doing things like they're looking at genome size. So I think many people won't realise that with plants, they have this extraordinary capacity to undergo whole genome duplication. So you end up with these polyploidy plants. If you've got many copies of a genome, then you've got much greater genetic variability and greater resistance to environmental perturbations. So you can see immediately that you can start to see a direct relevance to if you're going to perturb an area with an environmental shock, which plants are going to actually be able to get through that. So there are all these questions about resilience in there and an environmental change that Kew can address with this big data.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and joining me today and for talking about all the wonderful work that's going on at Kew, and we look forward to hearing you on Radio 4.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A huge thanks to Professor Willis there. And to hear the epic 25-part series, Roots to Riches, tune into BBC Radio 4. The first part airs on the 21st of July at 1:45 p.m, but I'm sure you can catch up on the BBC's iPlayer. That's all we have for you. Remember, for breaking botany-related news and so much more, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Ian Sample, producer Jason Phipps, and all the science team, thanks for listening. We'll be back next Monday. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.